Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
Looking westward from Athens, it rises like a rock, Salamis. It looks more like a fortress than an island, separated from the mainland only by a strip of blue water, the Salamis Straits. Once independent, by 480 BC, the island had long belonged to Athens, whose rule extended across the narrow channel. In these straits in 480 BC, on or around September 25th, a great battle took place. In the early autumn, when night and day are of equal length, 1,000 warships fought over the future of Greece. An invading Persian armada aimed to add Greece to the greatest empire the world had ever seen. The stubborn natives rode for liberty or death. The day dawned white. When, 12 hours later, the sun went down red, the remnants of one fleet came flooding out of the straits, pursued by another. In these straits, the gods of battle had to decide whether to give their favors to the Persian navy or the Greek fleet. In the months before Salamis, the Persians had marched through northern and central Greece, crushed the Spartan army at Thermopylae, fought the Athenian navy to a standstill at Artemisium, and entered Athens in triumph. They had burned the old temples of the Acropolis to the ground. With their vast armada, the Persians expected victory at Salamis, but the gods had always disapproved of an excessive taste for vengeance, and the Persian king Xerxes had a parched throat when it came to Greek blood. The world had never seen a battle like Salamis. A channel only a mile wide held the fighting men of the three continents of the Old World, Africa, Asia, and Europe. The Persian fleet included not only Iranians and men from Central Asia, but Egyptians, Phoenicians, Cypriots, Pamphylians, Lydians, Cilicians, and Greeks from what is today Turkey and the Aegean Islands. The Greek fleet had contingents from 24 separate city-states, most from the Greek mainland, but some from the Aegean and Ionian Islands, and one lone ship from Italy. The Battle of Salamis represented a huge demographic fact. More than 200,000 men fought there. Perhaps 20,000 soldiers lined the shores to help or hinder survivors. In addition, about another 100,000 women, children, and old men had left Athens as refugees, for a grand total of about 300,000 combatants and civilians. 300,000 was an enormous number in the world of 480 BC. In today's terms, it would be equal to many millions of men and women. As for the sailors at Salamis, they were certainly diverse. They ranged over a variety of races, ethnicities, and body types. They included citizens and slaves, kings and commoners, cavaliers turned ship's captains, as well as lifelong Marines. They spoke a hodgepodge of languages, and Greek was heard on both sides. In fact, as many Greeks fought for Persia as against Persia. But that's just one of the many paradoxes of Salamis. And so we need to ask, what was this battle? What was it all about? And how and why did it develop the way that it did? Well, Salamis was part of a war that began in the 540s BC, so about 60 years or so earlier, when the Persians conquered the Greek city-states on the coast of what is today western Turkey. Those city-states rose in rebellion against Persia in 499, almost 50 years later. At first, Athens sent aid to the rebels, and this infuriated the Persians, particularly because a few years earlier, the Athenians had requested becoming a Persian ally, and then Athens changed its mind. The Athenian expeditionary force to help the rebels burned a temple to the ground in the Persian provincial capital, and then it beat a hasty retreat as the Persians sent reinforcements. 5 years later, Persia crushed the revolt. And then it tried to get revenge on Athens. From the Persian point of view, the Athenians were guilty of multiple sins. They were, first of all, liars. They had asked to become an ally, and then they changed their tune. Persian religion emphasized truth. Truth was one of the great virtues of the Persian religion. Secondly, the Athenians were desecrators. They had destroyed a temple. And third, the Athenians were humiliators. They had embarrassed and insulted Persia by their act against it. From the Greek point of view, as Persia came to the Greek mainland in search of revenge, the Persians were invaders. Secondly, the Persians were tyrants, literally so, because in the various Greek cities that went over to the Persian side or that were conquered by Persia, the Persians did business with tyrants, with one or two families that governed the city in the interests of the Persians. As we'll see, many of the Greek cities of the mainland were quite different. Finally, when the Persians destroyed Greek temples in turn, they too were desecrators. So after putting down the rebellion of the Greeks in 494 BC, Persia crossed the Aegean Sea and attacked Athens at Marathon in 490 BC. When that failed and the Persians lost the battle, they came back with a bigger and better and more terrifying force 10 years later. In August of 480 BC, Persia won a hard-fought, costly victory at Thermopylae. For the Greeks, it was a physical defeat, but a moral triumph. Afterwards, the Persians marched unopposed to Athens. They attacked the skeleton force that held the Acropolis. They killed the men, and they burned the temples down. Where was the Athenian army? Where was the Athenian navy? On Salamis. It was all part of the plan of one brilliant, courageous, and utterly unscrupulous man, a person who we need to turn our attention to now, a man named Themistocles. Themistocles was one of the greatest strategists of the ancient world. He was also an Athenian who represented the triumph of democracy. In 480 BC, at the time of the Battle of Salamis, a time of the Persian invasion of Athens, democracy was in its infancy. This is really just the first generation of democracy. Athens became a democracy 28 years earlier in 508 as the result of a revolution. And that revolution had effects that rippled out in Athenian politics, culture, economics, and the military. For one thing, Themistocles could never have risen to power in his country if it had not been a democracy, because he was a member of the nobility only on one side of his family. The other side of his family made him a relatively ordinary person, and he did not fit the aristocratic ethos that the leading people in his society were proud of. He once said he made a virtue of the fact that he was a populist, as it were, to use an anachronistic term. Please forgive me. He once said, "I might not know how to sing or tune a lyre, but I know how to make a city great and free." That's lyre, of course, as in the ancient equivalent of a guitar. I might not know how to sing or tune a lyre, but I know how to make a city great and free. And indeed, he was as good as his word, because he came up with an innovative plan for victory. When the Athenians defeated a Persian army at Marathon in 490 BC, many people in Athens thought the war was over. They'd made their point, and the Persian threat had been taken care of. Themistocles knew better. He had a unique capacity for predicting the future. And he knew very well that the Persians would come back, but this time they would have a bigger army and a big navy. And so he wanted to prepare Athens to fight. And indeed, he wanted to lead the Athenian force against the Persians. His plan was that Athens would have to become a major naval power, which it had never been before, and that it would have to build a state-of-the-art navy. Now, navies are expensive, and Themistocles could never have carried out his plan if not for a bit of luck. In the year 483 BC, the Athenians discovered a strike of silver in the state-owned silver mines in the southern part of their country. It was a great deal of wealth. And because the state owned the silver mines, the people of Athens, in their democracy, got to decide what to do with it. And Themistocles convinced them that instead of spending this on payments to each of them, instead of distributing the wealth, that rather they should dedicate it to building a navy. And he convinced them that the Persians would be coming back. And so in 483, the Athenians agreed to sacrifice, to give up the possibility of greater personal wealth, and instead to build a navy for the good of the country. As we'll see, the navy was only part one of Themistocles' plan for what to do when the Persians came back. On the Persian side, the Persians were led by their king, Xerxes. Now, it was not unprecedented, but it was unusual for the king to lead the army in person, as Xerxes did. He really wanted to conquer Greece. He wanted his name to be associated with this, and he felt that he could legitimize himself for all time by this victory. Persia was still a conquering empire. It had known some setbacks, but Persian kings tended to prove themselves by adding to their possessions. And for Xerxes, the expedition against Greece was going to do this. He wanted to make it the biggest, best expedition that the Persians had ever put on. So it was a large army and a large navy that crossed the Hellespont and invaded Greece in 480 BC. One of the many sub-commanders in his navy was a woman named Artemisia. She was queen of the city of Halicarnassus. Nowadays, it's known as Bodrum. It is a resort town on the Aegean on the southwestern coast of Turkey. In antiquity, it was an important port city that had been settled both by Greeks and by Persians, and there were the native peoples who were there before either one of them came to town. So it was a multi-ethnic and multicultural city. Artemisia was the queen, rather she was the widow of the former king or tyrant. She had a son who was coming to the throne, but she pushed him away and insisted on leading the small navy that her country sent to join the Persians in the invasion of Greece in 480 BC. She was, in fact, the first recorded female admiral in history, which is a remarkable distinction indeed. One other person who I want to mention is Aeschylus, the famous Athenian playwright, the earliest tragic playwright in history whose works survive. He took part in the battle, and he later wrote a play about it called The Persians, and it was put on in Athens in 472 BC in the Athenian Dramatic Festival, where it won the first prize. And luckily for us, the play survives to this day, and we can glean important information from it. So let's go back to Themistocles' plan. How was Themistocles planning to defeat the Persians when they invaded Athens, as he knew they would? As I said, he built a fleet. The first part of the plan was building the fleet. The second part of the plan was evacuating Athens, getting every man, woman, and child voluntarily to leave their homes. Most of the women and children would go on the other side of the Saronic Gulf, in the Greek city-state of Troezen, hereditarily associated with the Athenians, and most of the men were to cross the channel and to go to the island of Salamis and to either take part in the navy there or to help the navy there in a support position, in one support position or another. The next part of the plan was to lure the Persians into fighting in the Salamis Straits. Why did Themistocles insist on fighting in the Salamis Straits? There are, after all, lots of bodies of water in Greece, which is a nautical country. It's because the Salamis Straits were the one place where they could fight a battle and where the Persian superiority in numbers would turn into a weak point, where far from being able to deploy their superior numbers, the Persians would find their ships crowded and bumping into each other, whereas the leaner and meaner Greek navy would be able to deliver powerful blows against the enemy. I said the Greek navy was leaner and meaner. It's certainly smaller in number, but in fact, the Greek ships were heavier than the Persian ships at Salamis, which means that each punch that they could deliver in a narrow space would be all the more powerful. It's a great plan, but the problem is convincing people to carry it out. First of all, he has to convince the Athenians to evacuate their homes and to know they might never be able to come back. Themistocles was only able to do this by enlisting the help of religion, by convincing people that the gods themselves wanted them to abandon Athens and go across the channel. And in fact, he is shameless about doing just that. Well, that, in a way, is the easiest part of the plan, to get the Athenians to leave, because after all, the Persian army is pretty frightening. The second part of the plan is to get the other Greeks not to leave. The Greek navy was based at Salamis as the Persians came south. Most of the city-states that had provided ships for the navy, and there were 23 city-states, most of them didn't want to stay at Salamis. Most of them wanted to go further south to the Peloponnesus, that leaf-shaped peninsula that makes up southern Greece, if you look at a map of Greece today. That's where their home cities were located. That's where they wanted to put up a fight against Persians. Themistocles knew that there was no place around the Peloponnesus that was as advantageous geographically for the Greeks as the Salamis Straits, besides which he wanted to fight the battle as close as possible to Athens. Even though much of Athens was a smoking ruin, he did not want to risk the connection between the land of Athens and the Athenian people. He wanted to make it clear to everyone that the Athenians planned to defeat the Persians and go back home, that they had suffered not a disaster, but just a temporary setback. So the challenge for Themistocles was pull this off. Now, he did pull off the Greek evacuation by using religion, by convincing people that the gods themselves wanted the Athenians to leave, and also by getting the support of the prestigious aristocrats in Athens who made it clear that they were on board with Themistocles' plan. So at Salamis, the Greek fleet, which includes ships from states like Sparta and Corinth and Aegina, the island off the coast of Athens, and further than Salamis, and other Greek city-states as well, this fleet consists of 368 Greek ships. If it had a full complement, there would have been 62,000 rowers. The largest contributor to this fleet is Athens, which contributes 180 warships. The smallest is the little island of Seriphos, which contributes one pint-sized warship, not even a regulation-sized warship. The leader of the fleet, the leading commander, is not an Athenian, but a Spartan, even though the Spartans contribute far fewer ships than the Athenians do. Why is a Spartan a leader? Because of the military prestige of the Spartan army and because of its victories, its long string of victories throughout history. So a Spartan is leading the fleet, even though the Athenians will play a much bigger role. So the battle, as I said, took place on or about September 25th, 480 BC. And for the battle to happen, as Themistocles had planned, he had to lure the Persians into the straits, and he had to get the Greeks to agree to fight in the straits. Difficult problem. The day before the battle, the majority of the Greeks on Salamis decided to pull their ships back to the Peloponnesus, in effect, to abandon Athens. Themistocles is not going to stand for it. He sends a slave on a secret mission to the Persian fleet. The Athenians are on the island of Salamis. The Persians are in the harbor of Phaleron, which is southeast of Salamis on the mainland. Themistocles sends his slave there, and his slave tells Xerxes, the Persian king, that his master, Themistocles, was ready to betray the fleet to the Persians. All the Persians had to do was send ships into the straits at night, and when dawn broke, the Greek fleet would be handed over to their hands. This is highly appealing to the Persians. The Persians had often taken advantage of treachery in battles. And although there was some opposition, Xerxes decided to accept the proposition of Themistocles' slave. Actually, it was the female admiral Artemisia who argued most vociferously that this was a trick. She was half Greek herself, and she said she was fully conversant with Greek tricks. Xerxes, she said, don't do it. But Xerxes didn't pay any attention. He decided that his navy was good enough and big enough to defeat the Greeks. Now, I've mentioned that the Greeks had 368 ships at Salamis. The Persians had about 700 ships. Not all of the Persian ships were in place when the battle began. Some were still entering the straits. When they were all there, there would have been an astonishing 150,000 men in the Persian fleet, not to mention 62,000 men in the Greek fleet. This, again, is if everybody was serving and if all the ships had full complements. The order of battle. The Spartans were in command of the Greek fleet, and they held the extreme right. The extreme right was considered the position of honor, because in an infantry battle, that was the position that had the least protection for your body from the shields of someone next to you. Next in importance to the Spartans was the Athenians, and they held the left wing of the Greek fleet. And next important to Athens was the little island of Aegina, which was located right to the Athenians' right. Now, Aegina was a small place, but it was a naval powerhouse, and it also had had the attention of the Spartans. So it was significant. So consider the fleets lined up on two sides, the Greeks on the island side of the straits and the Persians on the mainland. Now, I haven't told you how the Persian fleet came into the straits. Once they accepted the trick of Themistocles' slave, they boarded their ships, and that very night, they launched the ships and sent them into the Salamis Straits. They were seeking shelter along the shore, and they expected that when the morning broke, they would see the spectacle of a terrified Greek fleet that was trying to escape, and that couldn't escape from the Persians. In fact, one unit in the Greek fleet, the Corinthians, did try to escape, but it looks like that this was just a feigned retreat to draw the Persians off, and that the main Persian thrust was meant to come later and elsewhere. The Persians were well aware that the Spartans were not going to fight them at this place and at this time. There were an astonishing 150,000 combatants in the strait, if everyone was there. The Spartans held the extreme right, as I said. Next in importance was Athens, and they held the left wing. The men of Aegina held the spot to Athens' right. The Spartans stood opposite various Greeks who came from the area under Persian rule, while the Athenians and maybe the men of Aegina faced the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians had the best triremes. They had the best warship in the Persian fleet. And so if the Athenians faced them, it looks as if the best Greek warships faced the best Persian warships. Everything was set up for a epic battle. As the two fleets met, the Greeks roared a mighty battle cry. Aeschylus purports to tell us what this battle cry said. Perhaps it's better just think of it as background. Background of what went on that day. And in Aeschylus, he records the Greeks as crying out, "Advance, ye sons of Greece, liberate your country, save your wives, your children save, the temples of your gods, the sacred tomb where rest your honored ancestors. This day the common cause of all demands your bravery." Well, we don't know what the Persians said, but we can be sure that they answered in turn. At the beginning of the battle, the Greeks backed water, perhaps to close gaps in the line. So instead of advancing against the Persians, they went back a little bit. One Athenian commander, a man named Amenius of Pallene, took his ships out again and rammed a Persian trireme. He claimed to be the first person who fought in the battle. So the Greeks were backing up their ships. And suddenly one of them pulls out and he rams a Persian trireme, much to the Persians' surprise. What's it like to be rammed in an ancient naval battle? Let me tell you. Once the captain ordered the attack and the pilot passed the word on, the rowing master would rapidly move the crew up to a high stroke rate, perhaps approaching 50 strokes per minute. At that pace, every rower had to devote all his attention to the task at hand. So, by virtue of his trick, Themistocles lured the Persians into the straits. And the Persians launched their fleet, and on the night of September 24th, they launched their ships into the straits. Meanwhile, the Greeks were expecting to evacuate Salamis the next morning. But the word came that the Persians were coming, and that the Persians had already entered the straits. It was too late to evacuate, and the Greeks had to stand and fight. Themistocles had pulled off a perfect double cross. He had tricked the Persians into fighting the battle and tricked the Greeks as well. The Greeks were forced to stand and fight. He had everything that he wanted, just as he had planned it. The battle would be fought in the Salamis Straits. The Greeks were greatly outnumbered. The Persians had about 700 ships. The Greeks only had about 368 ships. That means there's a huge disparity in manpower as well. If they had full complements in their ships, the Persians would have had about 150,000 men, and the Greeks would have had about 60,000 men. So this is an enormous number of people fighting, roughly 200,000 men fighting in this battle. The Persian fleet represented a huge variety of nations and peoples, but the most important, the best fighters in the Persian fleet were first of all the Phoenicians, who lived in a series of city-states in roughly in what is nowadays Lebanon and northern Israel. And they were the best sailors and had the best ships in the Persian fleet. The Egyptians also had a great navy, and they were there as well. So did various Greek city-states in Turkey. There were large numbers of Greeks fighting for the Persians, about as many Greeks as there were fighting on the Greek side. And there were other contingents as well that made an important contribution to the Persian fleet. One of them came from the little city of Halicarnassus, as I mentioned, a contingent commanded by Artemisia, history's first female admiral. As for the Greeks, they had 368 ships. They represented 23 different city-states. The largest of the contributors to the Greek navy was Athens. The Athenians contributed 180 ships. The smallest was the little island of Seriphos that contributed one ship, and that ship wasn't even a large state-of-the-art ship. It was rather a smaller ship. And speaking of state-of-the-art ships, I should say that the state-of-the-art ship in this period of history was known as the trireme. The trireme. It was an oared warship whose rowers were deployed on three levels, hence the name trireme. There were about 170 rowers on a ship. On a Greek ship, there are about 170 rowers. There were about 15 marines, armed men on deck, as well as archers. And then there was a crew of various other people. The most important member of the crew was the helmsman, or the pilot, the guy who steered the ship. Persian ships were similar. They were triremes as well, these long, elegant wooden ships. And they had a large number of marines. They had about 30 marines on their ships, and their ships were taller, and they also had bulwarks to prevent the marines from falling in. As we'll see, that becomes an important detail later on. Just think about these ships for a minute. Each one of them was about 130 feet long. Now, how long is that? Well, if you imagine a racing eight, the kind of boat that you see college crews row on, where there's nine people, eight rowers, and one coxswain, a racing eight is about 60 feet long. A trireme is 130 feet long, so it's only a little more than twice as long as a racing eight, but it's got 200 or more people on it. Think how crowded a trireme was. Think what a concentrated force of humanity it was on one of these ships. And now let's imagine hundreds and hundreds of these ships fighting in the Battle of Salamis. On the Greek side, the Greeks deployed their navy in two lines, probably stretching about 2 to 2.5 miles long, with the island of Salamis in their back. And the line extended from a headland in the south to an islet in the north. So either end of the line had land, protecting the ships from being surrounded by the enemy. The Spartans were in overall command of the Greek navy, and they held the position of honor, that is, the extreme right. The reason it's called the position of honor is that in an infantry battle, the soldier who stood on the extreme right did not have anyone's shield. He did not have the shield of the person next to him to protect the right side of his body. Greeks held their shields in their left hand. It's also considered the position of honor in a naval battle. The next most important navy after the Spartans were the Athenians. They held the other wing. They held the left wing. And next to the Athenians came a much smaller contingent of ships from the island of Aegina. Aegina, it's within eyesight of Athens. It's located in the Saronic Gulf, and it was a traditional rival of Athens. So it's in the waters not that far from the city of Athens. On the other side, the Athenians and the people of Aegina, the men of Aegina, faced the best Persian triremes, the mighty Phoenician navy. The Spartans stood opposite various Greek ships, so good rowing ships as well, but not as good as the ships that faced the Athenians and the Aeginetans. As the two fleets met, the Greeks roared a mighty battle cry, and we get this from Aeschylus's play, The Persians. So perhaps it is slightly dramatized. Perhaps it's a little embroidered from what was said that day. Anyhow, the Greeks are supposed to have cried out, "Advance, ye sons of Greece. Liberate your country. Save your wives. Save your children. The temples of your gods. The sacred tomb where rest your honored ancestors. This day, the common cause of all demands your bravery." And we can be sure that the Persian fleet answered with a battle cry of its own in turn, although what they said is not recorded. So the two lines begin the battle, and then suddenly the Greeks backed up. They backed water, to use the nautical term. Why? Had they lost their nerve? Perhaps. Or perhaps it was to close gaps in their line, which had opened up as they advanced. We'll see in a moment there was another possible reason why they wanted to delay the start of the battle. And then one Greek ship started the actual brawl, the actual fighting. There was some dispute as to who started it, but one explanation, it was that it was an Athenian commander, a man named Amenius of Pallene, which is a district in Athens, that it was Amenius who took his ship out again and started the fun by ramming a Persian trireme. Now, what was it like to ram a trireme? Here's a description. Once the captain ordered the attack and the pilot passed the word on, the rowing master would rapidly move the crew up to a high stroke rate, perhaps approaching 50 strokes per minute. At that pace, every rower had to devote all his attention to the task at hand. For no more than a minute, it might seem to him as if nothing existed except a narrow, stinking tunnel of 170 men bent over in unison, as if rowing a single oar. Still, the mind might wander to home and happy times, to game and feasts, to anything except the split-second shock of collision. Muscles strained and lungs sucked in air. It seemed as if the agony would never end. And then, suddenly, just before the moment of impact, the rowing master, primed by the pilot, ordered the men to switch to backing water in order to keep the ram from penetrating the enemy ship too far. Then the crash came, and if all went well, the vulnerable attacker would already have begun backing off. Although working at extreme intensity, the men would have to work harder still, rowing the ship in the opposite direction from before. And that's what Amenius of Pallene and his men did as they rammed a Persian trireme. The ram was a success, but the problem was they weren't able to back off. Their ship was stuck in the Persian ship, and the Persians sent their marines onto the Athenian ship to attack them. The other Greek ships had to come to the aid of Amenius, and they did. They sent their marines in. They overpowered the enemy. They freed Amenius and his crew and his ship, and they went on to fight again. Now, the men of Aegina told a different story. They claimed it was one of their ships who had started the battle. they'd been exhorted by a divine apparition of a woman who said, "Come on, men, it's time to fight." And so the battle was on. The noise of it was overwhelming, magnified by the echoes of a narrow space ringed by hills. Now, the battle developed exactly as Themistocles had hoped. In the confined space of the straits, the Phoenicians were not able to carry out their signature maneuvers of rowing through or around the Greek ships. It was too crowded. The Phoenician ships were lighter and faster than the Greek ships. The Greek ships were heavier, but the Phoenicians could not do what they wanted. They could not take advantage of their lightness, their agility. They were also more experienced than the Greek navy, which was a new navy. The Greeks had the advantage, were able to use the heaviness of their ships to their advantage in this narrow space. And then the morning breeze began to kick in. As Themistocles knew, every day in the late morning, a light breeze would blow in from the sea. It wasn't much of a breeze. It rarely blew as much as 4 or 5 nautical miles per hour. But it could unbalance the Persian warships, which were higher than Athenian ships and had bulwarks. So the breeze would make them come down heavily. And one of our sources says that Themistocles waited for this breeze before he gave the order to charge. And so that might be another reason why the Greeks were stalling for time in the beginning of the battle. They were waiting for the wind to change. The result was everything that Themistocles might have hoped. The Phoenician line fell out of order. The ancient sources tell us about the shock of ramming and how all the sailors would fall backward in one direction or another. The Phoenicians were utterly defeated. They were humiliated. And when they went to give their excuses to their king, he was not amused. Xerxes was watching the battle as it took place. He was seated on a throne on a mountain on the Athenian mainland, the area that the Athenians had evacuated, and he looked down and saw his navy losing the battle. When the Phoenician admirals came to apologize, he gave the order that they should be decapitated. Now, they had the misfortune that when they went to see Xerxes, that was exactly the moment when the Greeks on the other side of the Persian line, when the Greeks on the Persian left were doing better. They're actually defeating some of the Greek ships. These are the Greek ships fighting for the Persians. They actually defeat some of their Greek ships. And as our sources tell us, many Greek commanders that day fought well for Persia. The battle went on and on. It began at sunup, and it lasted to sundown. It was hard fought, and it devolved into a number of individual combats. It did not go well for Persia. As Aeschylus puts it, the whole Persian force was undone, conquered by the shock of the ship's rams. One of the Persians who was killed was Xerxes' half-brother, a man named Ariabignes. As for the rest of the Persian fleet, more of them died in the confusion of ships coming and going than at any other time in the battle. As I said, at the beginning of the battle, not all of Persia's fleet was already in the straits. When the battle began, there were still ships pouring into the straits. And then as the Persians started losing, the defeated contingents turned and tried to come out of the straits. And the result was a monumental mess. Let me quote what Aeschylus has to say in his play. "At first, the flood of the Persian host held firm. But when the mass of ships crowded into the straits, there was no help for one ship from another. In fact, they were struck by their own bronze-mouthed rams, and the whole oared armada began to shatter. The Greek ships very intelligently started to strike around in a circle, and the hulls of ships lay upside down. And the sea could no longer be seen, because it was full of shipwrecks and the slaughter of men." Now, one slaughter that didn't take place is worth lingering on. It's the remarkable story of Artemisia, the first female admiral. The Greeks had put a price on her head. They'd given a reward of 1,000 drachmas for anyone who took her alive. You see, the Greeks were insulted by the fact that the Persians would send a woman to fight against them. They took this as a humiliating gesture, as if the Persians were saying, "You Greeks aren't real men, and we can defeat you with our women." In fact, that may be the reason why the Persians allowed a female admiral to serve in their fleet. It was a remarkable propaganda coup to use against the Greeks. Now, Ammius Apollini, you remember him, the Athenian who began the actual fighting. He sees Artemisia's flagship in the heat of battle, in the middle of the day, and he strikes out after her, planning to ram her. Artemisia sees him coming, and she realizes that she does not have the power to stop him. So what does she do? She does something incredibly clever and wicked. She rams one of her own ships. She does this to convince the Athenians that they were wrong, that this is not Artemisia's flagship. Maybe it's not a Persian ship at all, or maybe it's a Persian ship that has decided to go over to the Greek side. Now, by the way, the ship that Artemisia rams belongs to a rival ruler of a nearby city, somebody who had insulted her earlier in the war. And our sources speculate that maybe Artemisia did this because she thought she was killing two birds with one stone. She was saving her skin against the approaching Greek warship, captained by an ace, and she was also getting revenge on an enemy and killing him off. In either case, the maneuver is successful. The Athenian decides, hey, that wasn't Artemisia. After all, let the ship go. But what's happening on shore? Xerxes is watching. And Xerxes' men see what happens. They probably know the real story. They probably can tell that Artemisia has rammed one of their own ships. But they don't want to give Xerxes bad news. They saw what happened to the Phoenician captains who were decapitated. So instead, they tell him a lie. They say, "Look, sire, Artemisia has just rammed a Greek ship. Isn't that great?" And Xerxes, who either doesn't know the truth or doesn't want to cotton on to the fact that he does know the truth, who wants to keep up the facade, says, "Yes, that's great." And then he stops for a minute and thinks. And he says, "Woe is me. My men have become women, and my women have become men." In any case, the Persians lose the battle. There are many stories that the Greeks have preserved of this and that incident in the battle that is part of their victory. Again, we don't have the story from the Persian side. Our sources all come from the Greek side. And if the Persians had their story, they would undoubtedly tell it from a different point of view. But for what it's worth, we can say that the Persians before the battle had landed 400 elite troops on an islet in the straits, and they were there to kill any Greeks who sought shelter because they thought the Persian fleet would destroy the Greek fleet. Instead, an elite unit of Athenian troops lands on the same islet and slaughters the 400 Persians. Or there is a story of a man named Democritus of Naxos. Naxos was an island in the Aegean Sea that was ruled by Persia. The Naxians sent ships to fight at Salamis for the Persians. But this guy, Democritus, he defected to the Greeks. And commanding his ship, he took out 5 Persian ships. And he recovered a 6th Greek ship that the enemy had towed off. So this is a great record of success as well. As for our friend Ammius of Pallene, Ammius the Athenian, he won a prize for valor after the battle. We don't have any contemporary sources that tell us how the battle turned out, but a much later source claims that the Greeks lost over 40 triremes and the Persians lost over 200. So a very lopsided total. Even though the Persians had a lot more ships than the Greeks, this is a tremendous loss if they lose over 200 warships. And if that's the case, then they probably lost at least 12,000 men. So a stunning defeat for the Persians. In summary, why did the Persians lose and what were the consequences? One of the ancient writers says that the Persians lost the battle because their battle line lost its order. The Greeks kept their order, the Persians lost theirs, and that made all the difference in the outcome of the battle. I think that's true, but I'd like to add three other factors. Shock, command, and geography. Shock. When the Persian navy entered the straits on the night of the 24th, and then on the morning of the 25th saw that the Greeks were not fleeing, on the contrary, the Greeks were getting ready to fight, that was an enormous shock. It was a surprise, and surprise is a very effective force multiplier. I might add parenthetically that the Greeks had spent the night on shore, while the Persians had spent the night at sea. And even though they were in the sheltered waters of the strait, it's a lot more difficult to get rest when you are at sea than when you are on land. The second fact is command. Many commanders were killed in the Persian Navy, and the Persian Navy, although it had many strong points, was not a democracy and not a military unit that encouraged individual initiative. It could be decapitated, as it were. And once you kill off a lot of Persian commanders, you have a lot of ships that don't know what to do. And finally, geography. The straits. The fact that Themistocles got his wish, carried out his plan, and had the battle fought in the straits. That was so advantageous to the Greeks, who had a smaller, heavier navy, and such a loss for the Persians, who had a larger, lighter, more agile navy. It prevented the Persians from deploying their strengths, and it allowed the Greeks precisely to hone their advantages and to win the battle. The next morning, the surviving Persian fleet was at its base in the Athenian harbor at Phaleron Bay. And as they looked back at the experience of the day before, they might have thought about missed opportunities and the horrendous spectacle they had witnessed. First of all, unlike Greeks, who prided themselves on knowing how to swim, most Persians did not know how to swim. So any Persian who had survived the ramming of his ship and the foundering of his ship would have found it very difficult to make his way to shore, not knowing how to swim. On top of that, there were many people who survived the loss of their ships, only to find themselves shot by Greek archers or even clubbed to death, as some of them were, clubbed to death in the sea as they were clinging on to debris, and they lost their lives in that miserable way. With over 200 ships gone, the Persians would have found or would have seen that there was debris all over the straits, and indeed there might have been debris coming out of the straits, coming back towards Athens. Dead bodies floated ashore on both sides of the Salamis Straits for days afterwards. Now, although the Persians still had the majority of their navy, and although they still outnumbered the Greeks, they had to admit the fact they had suffered a devastating defeat, and they no longer could be certain that their remaining fleet could defeat the enemy. Furthermore, they no longer could guarantee the safety of their king, and he very quickly made the decision to turn back home and return to Persia, leaving an army on the Greek mainland, an army that the Greeks would still have to deal with. But the naval expedition was over. Now, finally, what did the battle accomplish? Did the battle lead to a complete Greek victory? Did it end the war? It did not. The war continued into the next year. The war lasted almost another year. It was not decided until the fighting season of the next year, 479 BC, when the Greeks won two additional victories. A land battle was fought in central Greece, north of Athens, at the city called Plataea, where the Greek army, spearheaded by the Spartans, defeated what was left of the Persian expeditionary force, including the tremendously potent Persian cavalry. And traditionally, on the very same day, certainly around the same time, a naval expedition led by the Athenians defeated the Persians at the Battle of Mycale off the Aegean coast of what is today Turkey. So Salamis was not the end of the war, but it was the turning point. If we want to think of it in terms of more recent history, Salamis was Gettysburg. Appomattox had yet to be fought. Salamis was Stalingrad. Normandy, D-Day, and the Battle of Berlin had yet to be fought. But it's one of those dramatic moments when East met West and the whole world held its breath. As Voltaire once put it, if things had gone differently at Salamis, we might be speaking a language based on Persian today rather than a language based on Greek. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to find out more, well, then in a moment of shameless self-promotion, I will tell you that I have written a book on this very subject. It's called The Battle of Salamis, the naval encounter that saved Greece and Western civilization. Published by Simon & Schuster, it's available on Amazon.com and other platforms. Thanks for listening today, and I look forward to taking you through another great ancient battle next time. Please like us on iTunes, and if you are so moved, write a review.
Theme music by Lush Life.